We've been moving through the book of Leviticus. The last two weeks, we've been talking about the different offerings that are in the book of Leviticus. There are five different types. The first three mentioned actually have nothing to do with sin. A lot of Christians don't know that. But yeah, the majority of sacrifices in the Old Testament had nothing to do with sinning. The first one is the burnt offering. And it was a symbol of offering all of yourself to God. So you would take an animal and you would kill it, and you would offer all of that animal to the Lord as a symbol of saying, like, I want to be like this animal. I want to offer all of myself to you. The second one was the Thanksgiving offering, or the communion offering, or the meal offering. And that one was just saying, like, it was a desire or a time to give thanks to God, and it was a time to express your desires to commune with God, to be close to God, to be near to God in everything you're doing. And then there was the peace offering, which was, again, it was another type of a Thanksgiving offering, but it was a thanks specifically for the peace that God brings into your life. It was a thanks specifically for how God brings unity between you and Him, and it was a thanks for how God brings unity in your own life, whether it is from the brokenness of your past, or whether it is from the different relationship brokenness you have in your life. It was a time to give God thanks. And what we've been talking about is that those three free will offerings, right, they weren't things that people had to do, but they were things that God wanted people to do. Those free will offerings that people made, we still make them today. We don't offer anything on an altar. We don't burn an animal or give any grain to a priest. But what we do instead is we make these thanksgivings and these prayers to God on a daily basis to remind ourselves that our lives are about Him and not about ourselves. And to always remember that it is only God who could actually ignite our hearts towards Him. Right? That's not something that's natural for the human race. Right? It's not natural for me to love God. It's natural for me to love myself and to want what's best for me. It's unnatural for me to put God first. Right? And so we have to pray and ask for God to do that. And we also talked last week about how Jesus ultimately fulfilled those three offerings in His life and death. Right? That Jesus, although we cannot offer all of ourselves to God, God certainly offered all of Himself to us. And while we can't be perfectly thankful and commune with God, God came down and He was thankful and He communed with us. And while we are not perfect and peaceful in everything that we do, God, who is the Prince of Peace, once again, He descended and He brought peace to our lives that didn't have it previously. So that's how Jesus has performed these. These next two offerings, we're going to take 2 weeks studying them. The first week that we're going to study them, we're going to talk more about the principles behind them. And then the next study, we're going to be talking about practically, how do we do this today? Right? How do we exercise these things today? But these are big, these are heavy ones. These are the ones that most Christians are aware of. The sin offering and the trespass offering. These were not free will offerings for the people of Israel, meaning that they had to do them. If you sinned, if you blew it, you had to do this. This was not an option. Based on the fact that they had a deal, they had a covenant, they had agreement with God, in that covenant, God says, you are going to be holy for I am holy. You're not going to sin because I'm sinless. But if you sin, I have this thing that you can do that will garner my forgiveness, right? These rituals that you can do, that if you do them, if you perform them with the right heart and the right motivation, I will forgive you and we can continue to have unity between us, all right? So the three things I want to talk about tonight, just so you guys get your heads around kind of the principles of these things, is we're going to talk about why these offerings were done, how they were performed, and what does this show us today for our relationship with God? So let's start with why. So let's look at these two different offerings. It's the sin offering versus the trespass offering. The sin offering was one that you would make when you unintentionally blew it. So it was either you promised to do something. Let's say you made a vow to God. You said, God, I'm never going to lie again. And then, you know, you accidentally told a lie and you're like, crap, you know, I messed up. You know, and it's not something you were premeditating. It was something you just did on accident, right? That's the kind of sin that we're talking about. So if I accidentally, you know, lose my temper at my wife, or if I accidentally, right, it's something that I'm not premeditating, I'm not planning on doing, but I do it, right? I do it anyway. I blow it. I sin unintentionally. That's what we're talking about with the sin offering. If you did that, you would perform the sin offering. The trespass offering was different. The trespass offering was premeditated sin. So that was, you knew that something was wrong and you did it anyway, right? So this would be, I know that viewing pornography is wrong. I know it's wrong while I'm looking at it on the computer, and yet I'm still looking, right? That's the trespass offering. I know it's wrong, I'm doing it anyway. I'm thinking about it throughout the day, and then I'm acting it out at night, right? That's the idea of a trespass offering. It also was the offering that you would perform specifically if you sinned in such a way that it impacted somebody else. All right, so a lot of our sins, every sin that we commit is going to impact the people around us at some level, but some more than others, right? There's a big difference between me, say, stumbling to lusting in my heart tonight, which is a sin, versus committing adultery on my wife, right? Those two will have greatly different repercussions on her, right? One is far more serious than the other. There's a difference between me hating somebody in my heart, which is a sin, and then going out and beating that person up or killing them, right? One has much greater consequences than the other. And just as there are other sins that you can do that can greatly harm somebody, you would perform a trespass offering for those. So that's kind of just a little bit of a primer on what the difference between the two, okay? Now the point of both of these offerings was to show that we were sorry before God for sinning and that we wanted to be made right with Him. So it was to show God that we were sorry for what we did and we want to make things right, right? That's why you would perform this particular offering for God. Now that's a tough thing for a lot of us to wrap our minds around. We just did a whole study. I encourage you guys, if you weren't there, to listen to them online. We did an entire study on the topic of sin recently, so I'm not going to rehash all that. But it's really difficult for a lot of people in our culture to utilize the word sin because most people don't know what it is. Usually when I utilize the word sin to somebody, what we tend to think about is some sort of a forbidden fruit, right? It's some sort of a tantalizing thing that you want to do, but God says no, right? That's why we call Las Vegas Sin City, right? Now, when people call Las Vegas Sin City, they don't mean, oh man, it's an abominable place, right? What they mean is that there's a lot of fun there, but if you're a good Christian, you won't admit that, right? There's a lot of fun there, but you don't admit that, right? And we don't think about it, but you can go there and you can indulge a little bit of your flesh, and then you can come back, because what happens in Vegas, it stays in Vegas, man. You come back home and it's all good, right? That's what we mean when we use the word sin usually. The Bible means something very different. In fact, there was three primary words that the Bible uses to describe sin. The first one, it's sin. The second one is iniquity. And the third one is transgression. And I'll explain all those really quickly. And then hopefully we can understand a little bit about why God takes sin so seriously and why these offerings had to be made. The first one of sin means missing the mark. It was a term that was utilized for archers or marksmen or people like that, right? So if I was at the shooting range and I was shooting at a target and I missed the target, I sinned, right? I missed what I was aiming at. What God did in the beginning when He created us is He says, there is a perfect standard, and that's me. I am the perfect standard. You need to aim for me every time. Whenever we're sinning, that means we're missing the mark. We're not living up to God's standard. We're not living up to God's standard, which is, by the way, the source of our guilt. Guilt comes into the conscience of a human being when they aim at a standard and they miss it. Right? If I don't think that there's anything wrong with, say, cussing, I'm not going to feel guilty after I cuss. But if I have a standard in my life that says that I believe I shouldn't cuss and then I do it anyway, then I feel guilty, right? That's what sin does. It makes you feel guilty. It makes you feel shameful because you were trying to meet a standard and you didn't quite make it, right? That's the idea of sin. You guys understand that? Okay. The idea of iniquity means literally to bend something, right? That's what it means. So it's the idea of not being upright or straight. It's the idea of being bent or skewed in a direction that you shouldn't be bent or skewed in, right? So when a lot of us think about iniquity, it's not simply missing the mark. It's not simply doing something that's wrong. Iniquity refers to something that's internally wrong with you. You guys get that? So it's not the idea of acting wrong, it's the idea of being wrong. There's a vast difference between me going out and stealing something from somebody, and the difference between doing that and the difference between admitting to you guys that I have kleptomania, right? That I enjoy stealing from people, that there's something wrong in my heart that enjoys stealing. Right? It's one thing for me to, like I said, to lust in my heart after a woman, and it's another thing for me to admit that there's something in my heart that likes to do it, even though I know that that's wrong. You guys get that? That's the idea of iniquity. It's being bent. It's being twisted, torqued in a way that's not appropriate. Right? When God created us, He created us upright, perfect, in His image. He didn't just create people that were able to do the right thing. He created people that wanted right things. Right? Adam and Eve delighted to do the commands of the Lord because they loved Him so much. Right? They wanted to be right with God. They wanted to have a relationship with Him. And they wanted to do what He asked them to do because they loved Him. We'll talk about that one in a second. That's a really important one. The final one is transgression. Transgression means to break a promise. It literally means to rebel or to create some sort of a broken relationship or a broken promise. So transgression and sin are kind of close, if you guys can see it, right? That to transgress means not just missing the mark, but it's a relational term. So again, there's one thing for me to say, hey, you know, I lied, right? That's missing the mark. But it's another thing to say I transgressed, meaning I lied to my wife, and that hurt our relationship. You guys get that? So transgression just focuses it in what you did on a personal, relational level. That's what transgression, that's what that word does for us. All right, so how do those three come into contact with God? And why is it such a big deal for God? Well, you have to understand two things about God. The Bible says that God is love, and it also says that God is just. Right? God is perfectly loving, and He's perfectly just. When God created humanity, He created humanity to have a loving relationship with Him. He did not create humanity to be a dictator to us. And we know that that's the case because everything else in the creation obeys God, but guess what? It doesn't have a choice, right? When the planets and the stars, you know, obey God's commands, they don't have a choice in the matter. When animals do things, it's instinct, right? That's why we don't get mad at animals for doing things, because it's their nature, right? If a human being molests another human being, we give him the death penalty. When I look out in nature and I see a dog humping another dog that doesn't want it, clearly, I'm like, whatever, you know, like that's just what dogs do, I guess. Now, if a father murders his children, he gets the death penalty. But if a male lion eats his children, that's just a lion being a lion, you know? There's nothing wrong with that, right? They don't have a choice. They don't have morality. You guys get that? We are the only creatures in this entire creation that have a choice. When God asks us to do something, we could say yes or no. We have a choice in the matter. The reason why God did that is because the only way to have a loving relationship with someone is to have choice, right? I love my dog. He's an awesome dog. But you know what? He doesn't really have a choice. You know what I mean? Like, I don't give him options. I'm like, hey, Riley, you can go wherever you want, bro. You know, if you want to live with me, that's cool. You want to live other ways, you know, that's all right too. You know, like, no, he has to live with me. Right? He doesn't love me in return. There's no choice there. Right? But I could say that my wife loves me because she has a choice. She could leave if she wanted to. She could be with someone else if she wanted to. But she chooses to be with me in spite of the fact that she could be other places. That's love, right? That's what is foundational and important to love. So that's what God did. He created us with choice because of His love for us. But the issue with love and the reason why it's so fragile is love is hinged on mutual trust and obedience, right? Mutual trust and obedience and desire as well. So, for instance, if I asked my wife to do something, what I would want is I would want her to want to do that because she loves me. Meaning I don't want her to just obey me, and I certainly don't want her to resent me and ignore me and rebel against me. I want her to want to do what I'm asking because I'm the one who's asking and because she loves me, right? So if I asked my wife, I was like, hey, you know, I'm going to be busy at work today. Would you mind please making me dinner? I don't want her on the phone to be like, fine, I guess I'll do it because you always get your way. Hang up. Be like, oh man, my wife's so awesome. She's making me dinner, right? Right? That's not love. That's not trust. That's not respect. There's nothing there that's loving. Right? I also don't want my wife to be like, say, oh yeah, I'll do it. But then inwardly in her heart be like, man, I hate that guy. Make your own dinner. And then I come home and it's not made. She's like, oh, I forgot. You know, like that's also what I don't want. I want her to be like, man, I love my husband. It would be awesome to do this for him because he's asked me to do it, right? That's what I would like. And on the same token, I know that she's the same way. Come Christmas time, if I give her a great gift and she's like, oh, thank you. I'm like, I had to. Don't thank me. You asked me for this. We're married. I had to. There you go, right? She doesn't want that. And she also doesn't want me to ignore it altogether. What she wants, what all of us want, is we want someone to want to serve us out of trust, obedience, and respect. Right? That's love. God created us with that capacity. He gave us commandments, but he said, I'm not going to enforce this commandment, meaning I'm not going to stand over your shoulder all the time and say, don't do that, don't do that, don't do that. I'm going to give you the option, right? I'm going to give you the freedom to do what you want. And what humanity did with our free will is we chose with our free will to doubt God. God provided us with this great creation, and he said, just trust me. Trust me when I say that this is right, it's right. And when this is wrong, it's wrong. Just trust that I'm a good God and I'm looking out for you and I love you. But Satan said, well, what if God is wrong though? Did God really say that? Is this tree really all that bad? You know, if you eat it, you'll be like God. You're going to know good and evil. You could decide for yourself what's right and wrong. You don't have to listen to that guy. And we're like, you're right, Satan. God is a jerk, right? And we ate the fruit. And we decided that we're going to determine for ourselves what's right and wrong. And right there, you see all three of those words implemented, don't you? We sinned, we missed the mark. We were supposed to not eat the tree, we did. We developed iniquity because now we're bent. And we distrust God in our hearts and in our souls. And now we're also bent in such a way where we are geared towards believing that what God commands is really what's good. And what God says that we should do is really what's bad. That's why, by the way, if you guys have ever babysat kids and you've ever wondered, why is it when I ask that kid to do something, he does it, right? I'd say, hey, don't touch that, and he touches it. Or I say, hey, don't say that, and they say it, right? What is it in humanity that makes us want to rebel so badly? This is it, it's our iniquity. We're bent. We automatically think when we have a command that someone's trying to oppress us and we want to rebel, right? We want to get out from under it. Paul, in his book to the Romans, in his letter to the Romans, he says, I didn't know that coveting was bad until I read it in the Bible. And then when I read it in the Bible, all I wanted to do was covet. Right? So right when he figured out it was wrong, it actually increased his desire to do it. Right? That's our iniquity. That's our bentness towards God. And then finally, we have transgression. We broke a promise with God. And because God is all loving, he can no longer have a loving relationship with us because we don't trust him. And trust is foundational to love. And because God is all just, we can't have a relationship with him because God must judge all sin. He can't look at some sin and be like, oh, well, that's not as bad as that, so I'm just going to ignore it. God is so just that he must judge everything that's wrong in this world. He is so perfect and pure, he cannot put up with any amount of sin. You miss the mark just a little bit, and it's a fail for God. Right? He must judge sin. So because of this, God has developed these two practices to heal what's wrong with us. This heals, first of all, the idea of sin and transgression, because when we sin against God and we transgress against him and his commandments, we're now offering up a sacrifice. We're acknowledging to God that you're just and you should judge what I did. But I'm asking you to instead look on this animal who's innocent. Look on this animal who's innocent. Take their life instead of mine. You have to judge what I did, but please judge this animal instead of me. And God would do that. And then you're also, by doing this faithfulness to God, you're repairing the iniquity. You guys see that? You're repairing the iniquity by saying, God, I want to trust you more. I want to believe in your justice. I want to believe in your mercy. And I want to believe in your grace. God, help me to do this. And by doing these actions and these rituals, it was repairing the iniquity in the human heart. So how were they done? Well, I've already kind of told you guys how they were done. It's very simple, actually. Leviticus 4, verse 1 through 4. I'll read this very quickly, explain it, and then I'll read Leviticus 5, verse 1 through 5, and explain that very quickly. It says, "Now the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, speak to the children of Israel, saying, if a person sins unintentionally," right, the sin offering, "against any of the commandments of the Lord, in anything which ought not to be done, and does any of them, if the anointed priest sins, bringing guilt on the people, then let him offer to the Lord for his sin, which he has sinned, a young bull without blemish as a sin offering. He shall bring the bull to the door of the tabernacle of meeting before the Lord, lay his hand on the bull's head, and kill the bull before the Lord." Okay, so you would bring a sacrifice, and this sacrifice, by the way, was directly proportional to your social status, right? So it had to do with your wealth, but it more had to do with your social status. So if you were wealthy and a ruler, you had to offer the bull, the most expensive sacrifice ever. If you were poor, if you were dirt poor, you could actually get away with just some flour. You could just throw some flour on the fire, and that's okay. You could either do birds or you could do some flour. And what you would do is you would bring this animal to the priest. You would lay your hands on it. We talked about this in the other sacrifices, that when you laid your hands on something, you would lean your weight on it, and it was a picture of saying, this animal is becoming me right now. Right, my sins and everything that's wrong with me, my iniquity, my bentness, my transgression, my sins, I am putting it on this animal, and God is taking his life as opposed to mine because he is gracious towards me. Right, that was the picture of laying on of hands. They would kill the animal then, and then they would take the fat from the animal. So they would saw the fat off the animal because God says, I got to have the fat. Right, God was into the fat, I guess. You know, and it was a picture of giving the best parts of the animal to God. Because the fat was, I guess, in Hebrew culture, the best parts, right? So you'd give the best parts to God. Then you would take the rest of the animal, they would carry the corpse outside of the camp. They wouldn't burn it on the altar. All the other sacrifices were burnt on the altar, not this one. They would take the corpse, and they would carry it outside the camp, and they would burn it there. Okay? The transgression offering, I'm not going to read it to you guys. It's in Leviticus 5 if you want to read it on your own time. The transgression offering was the same thing. There was only two differences. The first one is you had to confess your sins over the animal as it was being killed. And the second is that you had to make amends for whatever you did before you even brought the animal. Meaning when you came and you laid your hands on the animal and you started confessing over the animal, the priest would ask you. They'd be like, have you already made amends for this? And if you said no, they'd be like, I'm not taking this. You got to go make amends first, right? So if I ripped one of you guys off some money, let's say I stole $5 from you or something like that, I would have to return the $5 bill, and then I would have to give you a tax on it. I would have to give you 20% more on top of it, right? That was the law. Or if I hurt someone, I would have to make amends. I would have to apologize. I would have to make things right between the two of us. Doesn't mean that that person necessarily has to forgive me, but I have to make that effort to make things right before I can go before God. Because God says, dude, all humanity is made in my image and likeness. If you sin against one of my children, you've sinned against me. Make things right with them first, then come and deal with me. Right? That was the picture there, the trespass offering. But other than that, everything else remained the same. Okay, so what does this mean for us today? Right? How do we still perform this sin offering today? How does it affect our lives on a day-to-day basis? I know that was a lot of lead up for this, but I think it's important because this issue right here has one of the greatest potentials to ruin your Christian life out of any other issue in the Bible, I believe. This issue ruined me for years out of my life. My relationship with God was terrible until I was about the age of 22 because I misunderstood this issue. I didn't understand it in a proper way, and because of that, my relationship with God was terrible. Okay, so let me explain. I'll give you guys three takeaways from this sacrifice, and in each one I'm going to show you how I messed this up and how it really, really ruined my relationship with God. The first one that I didn't understand was these sacrifices show definitively that all sin has a cost. When you sin, when you miss the mark, when you hurt somebody else, there's a cost. Unfortunately, we live in a culture where we don't tend to believe that anymore. When someone sins, let me put it to you this way. If I were to hurt somebody, or if I were to steal from somebody, what the government would do to me is they would make me go to jail. Right? We call them correctional facilities, right? And the purpose of jail is not really to make people suffer anymore. The purpose of jail is to try to fix people. Right? That's the purpose of jail. You go to jail to correct you. You go there and you see therapists and you spend time in your cell and you have time away from humanity, right? To have time to learn social skills and to not be the way that you are anymore. And what they certainly won't do is they won't make me make amends with the person that I hurt, right? So if I, let's say I brutally beat somebody half to death, the court will never say, hey man, you know what? You got to go and you got to make things right with that person. You have to pay all their medical bills. You have to make things right with them. You have to ask for forgiveness. You have to be sorrowful in front of them. You have to make things right. Right? If that person could sue me, but that's a different issue. What the court is going to be most interested in is saying, now you go to jail for 5 years. So that means that our system of government doesn't care at all about the victim. We care about the perpetrator, not the victim. And that's why we have kind of a weird system of government. Now, because of that, this is kind of transferred over. It's kind of transferred over into our relationship with God, where when we sin, a lot of us don't believe that there's a cost to what we're doing, because the forgiveness of God is so free and so accessible. I've had to talk to husbands many, many times where they've cheated on their wives. They've committed adultery on their wives. And they'll come to me and they'll be like, Peter, I don't understand why my wife can't forgive me. God forgave me. But like, well, yeah, God forgave you, but God's perfect. And you cheated on your wife. There's a penalty for that, man. Like, there's going to be consequences for your action. Your wife is going to have some issues with you for a while. You can't expect things to just go back to normal. Right? Don't you understand that there's a cost for what you did? But most people don't understand that. We just believe that if we sin, God forgives us, so it's okay. Right? We don't understand that there's a cost for what we're doing. Not only did I not understand that there was an issue of cost, right? That when you do something wrong, you should pay something for that. I didn't really get that through my head. But then as I finally started to understand it, I started to understand it in a really negative view. Meaning, I started to understand that there was a cost, but I thought that I could pay it, which is really foolish. I thought that I could pay the cost. I felt like, yeah, I've messed up, but I can make up for it, right? So I've made some mistakes in the past, God, but I can make up for these mistakes through being good, right? So what I would do, and again, if this reflects on you, I'm not picking on you or anything. This is just what I would do. This is my own personal life. When I would sin, I would not talk to God for about a week or so because I was so embarrassed about what I did. And so what I would do is I would spend that week kind of beating up on myself a little bit, thinking over in my head about what a scumbag I was and how terrible a person I was and how disappointed God must be in me and how wrathful and vindictive he must be towards me, right? And I would spend that week kind of doing that. And then after the week was over, then I would go and talk to God again as if I had somehow paid the price through making myself feel terrible, right? And then not only that, but then I would try to do good things to make up for the bad things. So I'm like, okay, so I messed up. I feel guilty, right? I missed the mark. I sinned. I didn't reach the standard. I feel guilty. God, I'm going to do right things and right things and right things until that guilt goes away because I don't want to feel guilty. I don't want to feel full of shame. So I'm going to be a good person, and that will make me not have guilt anymore. I thought I could pay the cost. By the way, the Israelites made the same mistake. The purpose of this sacrificial system was to show that there is a cost and you have to pay it, but anyone with a mind would look at this and be like, how could a bull pay my debt? Right? A bull is an animal. Right? How could a bull possibly pay my debt? There's no way it could possibly make up for what I did. Right, but the Israelites started to believe that somehow these offerings made them perfectly right with God. Later on in the book of Hebrews, the writer of Hebrews has to say, there's no way, man. There's no way. The blood of bulls and goats could not sanctify the sinner. Couldn't do it. It could never bring you into righteousness with God. So So when you don't understand the cost, and you don't understand how high the cost is, that you can never pay it, it will lead you into either a relationship with God in which you live your Christian life feeling like your actions don't have consequences, right? And a lot of people live that way. They live as though their actions don't have consequences. And when they hurt people, they put it on the victim. All right, so the person who's been hurt, they're like, hey man, that really hurt me. And they're like, well, you're being too soft, right? You don't know what I've been through. You should get over that, right? You're being sinful right now by being angry at me. You're judging me. That's wrong, right? They put it on the victim, even though they're the ones that made the mistake. They don't understand that their actions have cost or a consequence. And when consequences do happen, they feel like it's unjust. Like, how dare you make me pay for this? This is ridiculous, right? They don't understand that there's a cost. But then if you do understand there's a cost and you think that you could pay it, you'll have an intensely legalistic relationship with God. You'll have an intensely legalistic relationship with God, where you will only feel good in your relationship with God if you're doing the right things. And the second you mess up, you'll feel like God doesn't want anything to do with you. Right? That's not the purpose of this sacrifice. The second thing I didn't understand, that I should have understood, that this shows, is that everybody sins. Everybody sins. This is planted in the Word in such a way that it assumes that everyone will have to make this. Everyone will have to do it. In fact, it specifically, in Leviticus 5, gives orders for how priests and kings need to do this. Meaning that even the most holy, righteous, and greatest people in all of Israel, the Bible is saying they're going to blow it too. They're going to need this offering because everybody sins. I didn't understand that, right? So after I got over the idea of sin has a cost, I know sin has a cost, but I'm trying to pay it, I would start going to church and I would have my legalistic walk with God and I would truly believe that I was the only person who was blowing it, right? I would come into church and be like, I'm pretty sure everybody around me is living a pretty good life. I think I'm the only one who's really blowing it in any severe ways. Right, because the only kind of confessions I ever heard from anyone were like things that, gosh, I pray that I only sinned in those ways. Right? They'd be like, man, my dog peed on the floor the other day. I got a little mad, you know, but it's okay. You know, it's all right. You know, I forgave my dog, you know, and I didn't do nothing. And I'm like, that's it. That's your only sinner. Man, like, you know, the other day my kid was crying and, you know, I thought about, you know, disciplining him out of anger, but I didn't, you know, I held back and, you know, so it's okay. Or, man, I know I should be reading my Bible more, but, you know, I don't always get into it as much as I should. Or, man, I should have been praying every day last week, but I only prayed like 6 days a week. And, you know, that's pretty bad, you know. And I'm like, gosh, that's your sin? That's your sin? That's nothing. You know, that's nothing compared to what I do on a daily basis, on a regular basis, the things that go on in my heart and in my mind and in my actions. Right? That's not confession. So I got this idea that not everybody sinned. I just thought that only people who sucked sinned. And I was in this suck category. And I started getting this idea, and this thought started to dawn on me of maybe I'm not saved. Right? Because if everybody else around me is saved and they're not sinning and I'm still sinning, maybe that means I'm not saved. Either A, I was saved and I fell out of salvation because I blew it. Or B, I've been fooling myself. I was never saved at all. And I can say with confidence that a lot of people my age struggle with this, because one of the greatest things that we have in our generation that's so different from any other generation is we have these revivals, we have these crusades where people come forward to give their life to God. We have unprecedented amounts of people who are coming forward 3, 4, 5, 6 times to rededicate their life to God. Now, why are they rededicating their life to God? It must be because they believe at some level that they're not saved, right? Even though they've gone forward 5, 6, 7 times, they still don't believe they're really saved. They're constantly struggling with, is God's wrath on me or not? Am I forgiven or am I hated? Am I loved or am I despised, right? Where am I with God, right? I didn't understand that. I had no peace in my relationship with God, is what I'm trying to tell you guys. It's impossible to have a loving relationship with someone like this, by the way. Right? It's absolutely impossible. The only thing, the thing that enables my marriage to work so well is because there's an unconditional promise of love that was shared between me and my wife. Right? That's how it works. if every day when I woke up, my wife was like, hey, be good, because if you're not, I'm divorcing you, right? If that was like how our marriage began every day, I'd never have peace or any love in our marriage. The only way that there's peace in our marriage is if I believe, even if I fail, I know my wife is on my side, that she loves me and she cares for me. She doesn't care for me about because of what I do for her. She cares for me because of who I am to her. Right? That there's a deep foundation of love and purity within our relationship, because it's not founded on action, it's founded on something better, deeper, greater. Right? Because of the fear that I had towards God, I was unable to love him. I was unable to love God. You know, this hit me pretty hard, because I always thought I loved God. I always thought I loved God because I obeyed God. But over time, what I realized is that what I was defining as love wasn't really love. If anyone would have loved me the way that I loved God, I would have been like, you are a hypocrite and a liar. Right? If anyone would have loved me the way I love God, I mean, could you imagine? I just think back on the way I treated God, and it's so weird. Because God calls us his he's our loving father. Right? What loving father is there that would delight in his son being like, Dad, I know you don't love me anymore because I'm a screw up. Right? Please don't kick me out of the house, right? Every day when they messed up in any way. Right? If I said that to my dad would be like, what are you talking about, man? Like, I love you. You're my son. You're special to me. Like, I care about you. Right? What loving father, right? Let me give you another example. I didn't pray about certain things to God because I really believed that God was out to get me. And if I prayed the wrong thing, God would ruin my life, right? So I was like, I was taking really special care to pray the right things, because I was like, man, if I pray for the wrong thing, God's going to jack me up, right? So I never prayed things like, God, whatever you want to do with me, right? I never prayed that, because I was like, oh my gosh, like if I pray that, God's going to send me to Africa and I'm going to get, you know, influenza and die at the age of 30. You know, like I can't pray that. I got to pray like, God, you know, help me out, you know? Or I can't pray like, God, you know, whatever person you have for me out there, you know, like I trust you, you know, I know that you're going to give me a good marriage. Right? I was like, oh my gosh, if I pray that, I'm going to get married to someone who's horrible, who's going to teach me how to love because of how terrible they are. And I'm going to have a reckless marriage, and it's going to be miserable. You know, I was always afraid, or, you know, I never prayed for things like patience, because I was like, then God's going to ruin your life, you know, because then he's going to try to teach you to be patient. And I was always terrified in my prayer life with God. I was very rarely honest with God, as a matter of fact. Right? When I was angry with God, I lied. I was like, God, I'm not angry. You know, I'm happy. You're awesome. Because I was afraid that if I said, God, I'm angry at you, God would be like, I'm done, you know, and leave me. Right? I had this weird relationship with God, and I called it love. It's like, no, I love God. I love God with all my heart, soul, and mind, and strength. For sure, I love him. I didn't love God. I had a very twisted relationship with him that was based on fear. It says in 1 John, perfect love casts out fear. There is no fear in love, because fear involves torment. Right? I was afraid of God. Right? John says, dude, there is no fear in love. There is no fear in love. If my wife came to me every night and she said, Peter, I am terrified that you're going to beat me, abuse me, or leave me, I'd be like, what have I done in our relationship to make you think that way? It would crush me to hear my wife say that. It would crush me. It would show me that my wife doesn't trust in my love for her, and that she doesn't reflect that love towards me. Right? That fear, that anxiety, it shows a distrust in the character of the person that you're with, and it doesn't come from love, it comes from guilt. It comes from guilt because you feel like you deserve a bad life at some level. Right? And that's not true. It's not right. Again, I lead a group on Tuesdays with Bo of men who struggle with pornography, and it's so heart-wrenching to hear these guys talk. They're like, dude, I don't think I'm saved. I'm like, why don't you think you're saved? They're like, oh, I fell to porn last night. I'm like, okay, that sucks. There's a cost, right? There's a cost to what you did. It's wrong, but Jesus paid it all, man. Right? Jesus paid it all. You're forgiven. You have a relationship with God. They're like, no, I don't believe that, you know, and they'll start quoting Bible passages to me. These weird out of context Bible passages to show that God is angry. God, no, God's pissed at me. You know, he is a God of wrath, and I'm under his wrath, and I'm a vessel for wrath, and I'm this and I'm that. And I'm like, where are you getting this idea from? It's not from the Bible, it's from your own heart. It's from this idea that you don't understand that everybody sins, that there's a cost of sin, that you can't possibly pay it, but that God paid it for you in the person of Jesus Christ. You don't believe that. And so because of that, you struggle with fear and guilt and anxieties, or you struggle with living a reckless life where you don't believe that your actions have consequences. But either way, you're not walking in this, right? Because you don't understand the theology. You don't understand the principles that are laid out. And neither did I. Miserable relationship with God as a result. One last thing I want to point out before I move on to my third and final point. Like I said, depending on your social status was the sacrifice that you had to make. The reason why that was is because Jesus, and in the Bible throughout, God throughout the Bible declares to us that to whom much is given, much is required. I mean, the greater position that God bestows upon you, the greater potential you have to hurt people. Right? The greater position, the greater potential. So when God is looking at someone who's not a leader, or even there was less harsh punishments for women, by the way, there's a really interesting passage in Hosea that I think is just, it's fascinating. In Hosea chapter 4, God literally says that he will not judge the women because the men suck as leaders. Right? And when I read that, I'm like, that's crazy. You know, God's literally saying, I refuse to judge the women because the men have not led them in good ways. Right? God is fair. And he looks at the leaders. He looks at the people who are in charge. Right? When God is looking at his people, he's not judging everyone the same. He's saying there are certain people that have potential to do way more harm. And so because of that, they have higher standards of how they ought to live. Anyone in a leadership position has higher standards of how they ought to live. They just do. Let me give you an example. This is something that everyone in our country, if I were to talk to pretty much anyone in our country, they would agree with me on this. Okay? If there is an adult hanging out with a two-year-old kid and the two-year-old kid is having a temper tantrum, they're freaking out, and they're even hitting the adult, can the adult hit the child back? No, right? Because obviously there's a different standard for each individual person based on what that person has the potential to do. You guys get that? Everyone understands this at a particular level. Okay? It works this way with leadership. I feel this burden pretty heavy on me. Not only am I called to be the head of the house in my marriage, which is terrifying, right? Because that means that God is going to judge me based on the way I lead my wife, but I'm also a pastor in the church, which means that God is going to judge me based on how I lead my ministries. That's terrifying to me. That's not something that I take lightly. It's something I take seriously because God judges based on your potential to do harm. He does. So that's an important thing for us to understand, right? I wanted to lay that out for you guys because, like I said, a lot of times because of the culture that we live in, people don't get that. And I've heard people say things to me that I'm like, that's so wrong. You know, I'll have kids from abuse come up to me and talk about how they brought the abuse on by being disrespectful kids. And I'm like, well, yeah, you probably shouldn't have been a disrespectful kid, but that doesn't justify your parent beating you or abusing you or neglecting you. Right? Or a woman who's like, yeah, you know, my husband beats me, but you know, I egg him on. I'm like, so what? You know, yeah, you shouldn't egg him on, but no way that justifies him abusing you. Right? It's like people don't understand that there's a difference between those who lead and those who follow, that God judges not on what you've done, but on your potential. That's a really, really vital thing for us to understand. Third point, God paid the cost because he loves us. This is a beautiful passage, one that I have memorized, but it's just, you guys got to read it on your own time. Isaiah chapter 30, verse 18. You got to read it in the NIV, though. The other translations don't do it justice. I'm just warning you on that. The NIV says this, yet the Lord longs to be gracious to you. Therefore, he will rise up to show you compassion. For the Lord God is a God of justice. Blessed are all who wait for him. I had to read that one over and over again because it was slowly demolishing my bad views of God. The more I read it to myself, the more it demolished my bad, negative, false ideas of God, because I had this idea of God that he was someone who rose to punish me. This passage says he rises to show me compassion. I thought that God was a God who longed to show me justice, This passage says that he's a God who longs to show me grace. Right? God is excited to do good things for his children. That's why Jesus counted it joy to go to the cross for you, to shed his blood for you. It was a joyous thing for Jesus to do because he loves you. He cares for you. Right? That's the purpose of the sacrifice. That's the purpose of the crucifixion. Your view of God has everything to do with your view of sin and your view of your own righteousness. And it has everything to do with it. Right? If you don't see your sins as having a cost, it's because you have a low view of God. You don't understand how just and holy and amazing he is. And if you don't see yourself as being loved and you don't have peace and you're guilty and shame-ridden all the time, you don't have a very high view of God's love. You don't have a very high view of how much God cares for you, how beautifully he adores you. Right? You don't see it in the correct context, in the correct ways. You have a lesser God when you do that. One of the main things that you and I are going to have to do because of the fall, because of our iniquity, is to retrain our minds. The Bible says, renew your mind. Renew your mind in the image of God. Train yourself to see God correctly, because we don't see him correctly. None of us do. Some of us are more broken than others, but at the end of the day, none of us see God as he truly is. None of us see God as he truly is. If I saw God as he truly was, man, my life would be radically changed and different. The more I see God, the more I am changed. If I really believed, if I really saw that God was as he claims to be, the fountain of all pleasure and the source of all joy, I would not go to the broken things of this earth over and over again looking for something that I've never found there yet. Right? When I'm depressed, I certainly wouldn't go to things like pornography and things like video games and things like that to make me feel better about myself. I would go to God if I really believed in what he says about himself. When I felt guilty, I wouldn't go to my works to try to make up for it. I would go before God and say, God, you have forgiven me. Help me believe that. Right? If I really had the right view of God, everything, every insecurity in my life would be solved as I look at God and I hear him say, you are blameless and without spot, and I greatly desire you. All of it would be healed in that moment. But I don't believe in it, I don't hear it, and I don't see it, because my view of God is too small. And he's trying to widen my understanding, and he is seeking to give me greater grace to see him properly. Right? When God brings grace to us, it perfectly satisfies the love and justice problems. Jesus' sacrifice not only solved the justice problem of God saying, I'm going to judge all sin in my son, and because he is perfect and because he is holy and because he is eternal, I could put every sin on him and he could take it. Right? It doesn't just solve the justice problem, it solves the love problem. Because like I said, we don't trust God. What does God do about that? He doesn't just say, trust me. Right? The people of Israel, they're trying in their works to trust God. They're saying, I want to trust God through these works, but it doesn't work. It doesn't do anything for them. That's why in Hebrews 9, verse 13 through 14, it says, for if the blood of bulls and goats and the ashes of a heifer, sprinkling the unclean, sanctifies for the purifying of the flesh, how much more shall the blood of Christ, who through the eternal Spirit offered himself without spot to God, get this, cleanse your conscience from dead works to serve the living God. Right? They're trying to do the right thing, but it's not working because trust isn't fixed through good works. That's why the writer of Hebrews says dead works. They could never do it. But Jesus' finished work gives you reason to trust him. Faithfulness in an individual, when it's broken, the only way to repair it is if that individual shows trust, shows faithfulness to you. If you don't trust God, the only way for your trust, your faith in God to be repaired is if God does something to demonstrate his faithfulness. And he did. He did. That's why the writer of Hebrews says that his blood alone is what cleanses your conscience and brings you away from those dead works. Why? Because he paid the price, not you. How much does this do for us? One more verse for you guys. And every priest stands ministering, this is Hebrews 10, verse 11 through 14, by the way. Every priest stands ministering daily and offering repeatedly the same sacrifices, which can never take away sins. But this man, after he had offered one sacrifice for sins forever, sat down at the right hand of God, from that time waiting till his enemies were made his footstool. For by one offering he has perfected forever those who are being sanctified. I love that verse, by the way. It's one of my favorite verses. It tells me that God has perfected me forever by faith. Not by works, but by faith. Right? If your perfection and the way that you see yourself is based on your works, you will be on shaky ground for the rest of your life. If it is instead based on the finished work of God and your faith in Him, you will be on firm ground indeed. Nothing will be able to shake you. Right? When I talk to those men, that's what I always bring them back to. I'll be like, do you trust in what God did for you? Is the blood of Christ sufficient to forgive you for what you did? Is what you did terrible? Yes. Should you feel sorry for it? Absolutely. But was what Jesus did for you on the cross, was that enough to forgive you or not? And that's the question that is ultimately going to solve your problem of a guilty conscience and the peace that you have before God. Let's pray. Father, I thank you so much for your word and how it does encourage and strengthen us. I ask that we would understand what your word says to us, God. That even though our sin has great cost, and even though there is a lot of things that we need to think about in what we've done, God, that we shouldn't just blow over the things that we've done. But however, as great as the cost is for all of our sins, you paid a far higher price. God, help us to rest in that assurance. Help us to know what you have done for us, and help us to learn how to truly love you, God, to know that you care for us, and to believe that. In your name, amen.